also Mickey Gilley, the Louisiana legend from Faraday, cousin to Jimmy Swaggart and Jerry Lee Lewis, on the enduring legacy of Urban Cowboy, the film of 1980 that spawned his career, and also that of Johnny Lee. Johnny Lee will be with us as well. Also on the show, Steve Call, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist on the U.S. turbulent relations with Pakistan, and Mark Whitaker, a veteran journalist on Smoketown, the renaissance of the great city of Pittsburgh. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster, and we're privileged to have Mickey Gilley as our guest. Mickey, of course, is a music legend and a Louisiana legend, and it was in the 1980s, early 80s, that Urban Cowboy became part of the American fabric, the movie starring John Travolta, and the movie, of course, involved Mickey Gilley in a big way, both the soundtrack and the honky-tonk, Gilley's, and life has never been the same since, has it, Mickey Gilley?
Yeah, you know what? It's been one heck of a ride since John Travolta did the film. It was turned into a country night fever, and it's been one heck of a ride in my career. I can tell you that the Urban Cowboy craze was still going on today.
And your club became famous worldwide. You had people coming nationally, internationally, converging to the Lone Star State to be at Gilley's.
Absolutely. You know, we introduced the club in 1971. It was called Shelley's. I put my name on it. And immediately after they put my name on the club, I got a local TV show in the Houston area. And the club became famous through the Houston area and the state of Texas. But then when John Travolta did the film, The Urban Cowboy, he introduced it to the world.
And, of course, you had a great career before and after Urban Cowboy. But the soundtrack certainly didn't hurt, did it?
The soundtrack has been incredible. When we opened the club in 71, I cut my first number one song on the national scene in 1974, with Room Full of Roses. And, of course, in 1979 and 80, when the film came along, it really launched me and Johnny into the stratosphere as far as our career was concerned. Johnny had Looking for Love. I had the song Stand By Me, and the rest is history.
And for those who remember the song and for those who don't, here's a sampling of Stand By Me.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see.
And Mickey, now you and Johnny have reunited.
Yes, and we're having the time of our life, really. You know, I'm fixing to turn 82 March the 9th, and Johnny's in his 70s. And not too long ago, we played Kenner, Louisiana, and all the people that showed up for the show. It was unbelievable to see the young people out there in the performance when we were performing the songs. They weren't even around when we did the film with John Travolta. It's unbelievable.
How were the 80s as far as how the audience gravitated to your music and made you a superstar? It was a heady time, wasn't it?
Well, when the producer came to me with the song Stand By Me, wanted me to do the soundtrack to come there for Cowboy. The record company I was recording for, which was Epic there in Nashville, they liked his production so well, they hired him to do my future projects. And lo and behold, he gave me a run of music that that has really launched my career and gave me an identity that I never dreamed I'd ever have. Like when he started doing songs like You Don't Know Me, That's All That Matters to Me, Headache Tomorrow, Heart Tonight, Put Your Dreams Away, Talk to Me, Fool for Your Love. All these tunes came about in my life, and it put me in a different category. So I was very appreciative of the fact that it got me away from the identity of being, a cousin of Jerry Lee Lewis, and gave me identity for being Mickey Gilley, who I really wanted to be anyway.
Well, I know you have had some health challenges, as most of us do when we reach a certain age, and you mentioned 82 years old, as in Friday. And things are going pretty well for Mickey Gilley, for you right now, aren't they?
I'm doing quite well. You know, I've endured heart surgery, brain surgery, back surgery. My appendix exploded, two airplane crashes. January the 3rd, I was in a car crash. I rolled the car three times with my son. And I'm still here at fixing to turn 82. I'm still out there working the road and performing and doing the things that I really love and enjoy. The bottom line that I told a friend of mine, I lost my my ability to play golf, which was one of the things that I really loved and enjoyed. But at least I'm still getting able to fly and also perform the songs for the folks. So it's been one heck of a ride, and I'm still enjoying life.
How was it growing up with your cousins, Jerry Lee Lewis and Jimmy Swaggart?
I talk about that when I mention the book that out on all three of us called Unconquered. And I tell the people, you know, I said, there's a book on all three of us. And I said, the most questions I get is, how was it growing up with my two famous cousins? And I tell them, I said, it was very interesting. If you want to know more about our growing up years, buy the book. It's only $20. I'll sign it for you. If you get Jim and Jerry to sign it, you'll have something.
Well,
so have a good time with that question.
But think about it, as I'm sure you have. Here are the three of you.
Well, we all three went to the same school, the same church, and we chased the same girls, and we all three went in different directions, and we all three had different impacts in the music industry. Jimmy, of course, you know, did his evangelistic ministry, and of course, you know, he recorded all those religious tunes, and Jerry Lee was a rock and roll. He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I accomplished, you know, some 17 number one songs in the country music charts. So we all three went in different directions, and we all three had success in the different types of music. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's just been one heck of a ride.
And you were all born 360 days apart.
Yeah, well, I'm 6 months in difference between me and Jerry and a year between me and Reverend Swaggart. I'm the youngest.
Well, it's been quite a career for Mickey Gilley, the pride of Faraday, and I know you haven't forgotten your homeland.
No, I still enjoy going in and play the places that we play down in Louisiana, and I saw some dates coming up in Lake Charles, Louisiana. We just got through playing the big show there at the Cashada. Had a great time. I think there was somewhere around between 4,000 and 6,000 people there. I don't know exactly, but it was awesome. And to see those young people out there in the audience, which wasn't even around when we did the film The Urban Cowboy, and did some of that music, it was quite a thrill.
Well, Mickey Gilley, it is always an honor to talk with you. Congratulations on staying the course and the Urban Cowboy reunion tour with Johnny Lee.
And we're having a great time. You know, we closed the show with the music from the soundtrack film The Urban Cowboy. If the people hadn't seen us in a while, they need to come see the show. I think they'll enjoy this stuff and have a good time. We tell some corny jokes in the show to get them laughing and having a good time. And between me and Johnny together, we've had 25-plus number one songs. Not as many as George Strait, but we've had quite a few number one songs in our career also.
Well, happy birthday, my friend.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thank you.
And now we're joined by the remarkable Johnny Lee, the other half of the Urban Cowboy reunion tour. You heard Mickey Gilley say, between the two of them, they've had 25 number one hits. And like Mickey Gilley, you remember Urban Cowboy with great reverence, don't you?
Heck yeah, I'll never forget that. You know, the song Looking for Love came out of the movie, and it that just catapulted my career up, you know, to what it was and what it still is, really, you know. It fulfilled a lot of dreams I'd been dreaming about since I was a kid, so.
Well, here almost four decades later, you're performing and getting a great response from the audiences, some of whom weren't even alive when Urban Cowboy premiered. That must be quite a thrill.
A lot of the kids wasn't even thought about back then, and well, maybe that's thought about, but they weren't born yet. But you know, they love that song, and it's kind of strange—not strange, but strange in a good way. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I'm gonna pull a 8 or 9 year old kid up on stage to sing it with me.
That is something. The movie became a movement. It made bolo ties and cowboy boots popular fashion trends across the country, and it launched country music into the mainstream. But what do you see as the legacy of Urban Cowboy?
It gave country music a whole new group of listeners. It brought over a lot of new faces in country music. It opened up a lot of doors, you know.
As far as you staying the course and performing as you do with Mickey Gilley, who is celebrating his 82nd birthday, Johnny.
I was going to go to the fire department and get a permit to put that many candles on the cake, but they rejected it.
How is it performing with him?
Oh, man, Mickey and I, we love each other like brothers. You know, it's great. It's something we started out a long time ago doing, and we're closer than most brothers are, I guess.
And when Looking for Love became the iconic hit that it still is, when did you know that, man, this is really something, that this is not your just not your usual song, that it's got a life of its own?
When I first heard the demo, I couldn't believe I didn't write it myself, although I did write some of the music to it. I knew it from the get-go. But whether that was going to be a hit is a whole other story. There's a lot of great songs that are cut that never get heard, unfortunately, you know. That movie was the tool that we needed for that song.
Well, Johnny, congratulations on your continuing success, the Urban Cowboy Reunion Tour with the incomparable Mickey Gilley, and quite a pair you are, and we're glad you're still in the game. And thanks for spending time with us, Johnny Lee.
Appreciate you guys keeping our music alive.
Well, I spent a lifetime looking for you. Single bars and good time lovers were never true. Playing a fool's game, hoping to win. And telling those sweet lies, and losing again. I was looking for love.
Our guest at this time is Mark Whitaker, the author of the critically acclaimed memoir, My Long Trip Home. He's the former managing editor of CNN Worldwide and was previously the Washington bureau chief for NBC News and a reporter and editor at Newsweek, where he rose to become the first African-American leader of a national news weekly. Mark Whitaker's book is Smoketown, the untold story of Smoketown, the other great black renaissance, and it's about the great city of Pittsburgh. And Mark Whitaker, congratulations on your fine work.
Thank you so much.
This is a story that probably most people are unfamiliar with. We know about Detroit and New York and some other cities, New Orleans, and the relevance of the African-American community. But in Pittsburgh, a city you know well, it is a major part of the fabric of that community.
Well, you know, I didn't actually know the story that well. My dad grew up in Pittsburgh, and I used to visit as a child. I would visit my grandparents, who were undertakers there, and my aunts and my cousins. But it was only when I wrote that memoir you referred to a while back. I was doing research on my dad's upbringing. He was born in 1935, so in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and I discovered that black community of Pittsburgh, although a fraction the size of Harlem or Chicago, had this enormous influence. It had the largest black newspaper in America at the time, the Pittsburgh Courier, some of the greatest Negro League baseball teams, the sports writer who introduced Jackie Robinson to Branch Rickey, some of the greatest jazz musicians of the era, and August Wilson, who was born in the Hill District in Pittsburgh and went on to become America's greatest black playwright.
Well, that city has changed through the decades, as many American cities have, but I don't know of any city that has been transformed as much as Pittsburgh.
It's undergoing, you know, a big renaissance right now. The steel industry has been replaced by tech investment and the medical profession. They have great universities there. Unfortunately, the neighborhoods I write about, the historic black neighborhoods, were largely destroyed by a combination of urban renewal and the riots of the 60s. So some of them are starting to come back, but not as fast as one would like. And I'm sort of hoping that as people revisit and in many cases learn about this history for the first time, it'll give them even more of an incentive to try to invest to bring back those neighborhoods.
Well, it's a city rich in culture. Athletically, we know about Pittsburgh, but musically, many great singers and musicians have Pittsburgh as part of their past. People like Lena Horne and Duke Ellington, Dizzy Gillespie. It is a who's who.
I write both about musicians who grew up in Pittsburgh. Billy Strayhorn, Duke Ellington's great collaborator, Billy Eckstine, the singer, Errol Garner, the great pianist, Mary Lou Williams, Ahmad Jamal. All of them sort of came out of Pittsburgh. But then there were also a lot of legends who were deeply influenced by the time they spent in Pittsburgh. So Duke Ellington, Billy Strayhorn there, Lena Horne, who came from New York, ran away from her stage mother in her late teens, moved to Pittsburgh to be with her dad, who was a racketeer, married a local Pittsburgh guy, ended up singing in the homes of rich white folks in Pittsburgh, and it helped kind of develop her sort of intimate singing style. So I think that people will learn in the book that it has an influence that goes even beyond all of the great people who were actually born and raised there.
The black newspaper, The Courier, it had a major impact on U.S. politics, and you have unearthed this in a big way. How important was The Courier to the culture of the city at its time?
The Pittsburgh Courier started out, it was founded in 1910, and at the time it was just a little four-page pamphlet of local news that was sold just in the Hill District. A figure named Robert Lee Vann, who is a huge character in my book, who was a migrant from North Carolina, the son of a slave cook, had come to Pittsburgh to get a law degree and ended up as the editor and then later the publisher and part owner of the Pittsburgh Courier, and transformed it over the next 20 years into the largest and best-selling newspaper in America. And among all of the other things that it did, it covered all the great sports figures, Joe Louis and the musicians and so forth. It took the lead in the 30s in urging black voters who at the time voted overwhelmingly Republican to switch to the Democratic Party. And that transformed over the course of the 30s the whole dynamic of American politics. And it also played a big role in rallying black support for World War II. So it had a huge political influence, not only within the black community, but really on sort of black on all of American history at that time.
Well, the city, as you know, is experiencing a boom in technology and an influx of young professionals. Could it be used perhaps as a roadmap for other communities wishing to do the same thing?
Yes, you know, I mean, well, look, you know, I mean, it all goes back, though, in Pittsburgh, and I think that this is something that I think is probably a lesson, in my mind, to education. A big part of the story of my book are the educational opportunities that that black folks had in Pittsburgh, both at the university level, but also at the high school level, going all the way back to the 19th century and early 20th century. And that's really at the root of the comeback of Pittsburgh now. So I think other cities and other communities that are looking, you know, Rust Belt cities and so forth, that are looking to emulate Pittsburgh, I think it starts with the quality of their educational institutions.
And Mark, you note that some of these tremendous parts of history, the Hill District that you've mentioned a few times, they weren't preserved. We've seen this in Baton Rouge, where the show is originating. Many parts of black culture have been neglected, and some have gone away. That is a sad development.
It is very sad, you know, and it's really sort of, in a way, a kind of a national shame in my mind that with all the progress that we made in America over the last 50 or 60 years, a lot of these historically black communities are actually worse off now than they were in the age of segregation. It's hard to imagine, but you know, I'm a big believer that all of these cities, as they try to sort of rebuild, have an incentive to to really try to do something for those neighborhoods as well. I mean, you know, it's going to take a big effort on the part of both city, national and city government, but also local businesses. But, I don't think all of these cities like Baton Rouge, like Pittsburgh, can fully come back without doing something for these neighborhoods.
And athletically, some marvelous athletes in various sports came from the Pittsburgh area. One was not African-American, who LSU fans know well, and Pete Maravich, who was from nearby Aliquippa. But
right.
Something about that area produced primarily men who went on to exceptional careers in a number of sports.
In basketball and football, some of the greatest quarterbacks of all time, you know, Johnny Unitas
Joe Montana.
Joe Namath and Joe Montana all sort of came from Western Pittsburgh. Arnold Palmer in golf came from the Pittsburgh area. But again, you know, in terms of the black community, I think that, you know, in a lot of the biographies that I read in doing research for this book about the athletes and the musicians who became famous, the authors sort of suggested that the fact that they had come from Pittsburgh was like an anomaly. It was sort of a miracle that they had come from that area. But in fact, I argue, and I think I show in the book, that it wasn't despite the fact that they came from there. It was partly because of it, and that the bar, in terms of competition and inspiration in the world of music and athletics, was so high in that area that you could come from there, grow up there, and by the time you were ready to go out into the larger world, you already had highly developed skills and a highly developed sense of what the best in that field was.
And some major universities as well that have some background that is exceptional. When we look at people like Andrew Carnegie and Thomas Mellon, these people not only were titans of business, they certainly had a commitment to education at all levels.
No, you know, and they were controversial in their time, you know, in terms of, you know, some of their business practices and so forth, but they ended up donating the fortunes that they made during the Gilded Age to universities, to libraries and so forth, to foundations, which still have a very beneficial effect today. And I think it's, you know, I think it's also sort of a lesson for, you know, what can be done with the new fortunes that are being made in America today in, you know, in technology and in some other areas. So, you know, sometimes people may not always like the way in which people acquire their fortunes, but it shows that they can do very good things with them that have a huge beneficial impact on people's lives long after they're gone.
The book is Smoketown, The Untold Story of the Other Great Black Renaissance. Congratulations on your important work and fascinating book, Smoketown.
Thanks so much for having me, Jim.
This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And our guest is Steve Call, the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Ghost Wars and the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. From 2007 to 2013, he was president of the New America Foundation, a public policy institute in Washington. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, previously worked for 20 years at The Washington Post, where he received a Pulitzer Prize for explanatory journalism in 1990. His latest work, Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Good morning, Steve Call.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, Afghanistan has been in the news for much of the last generation. In 1980, of course, there was a war there involving the Soviet Union, and perhaps it was not well understood by the Pentagon when the United States went to war in 2001. What was the understanding between the U.S. and what was going on there with the Taliban and al-Qaeda at that time?
Well, on 9/11, you know, the Bush administration felt it had no choice but to strike back because, in part, they didn't know if there was something more coming from al-Qaeda after the shock of September 11th, and they knew al-Qaeda was in Afghanistan. They wanted to get their leaders worrying about survival and stop thinking about another plot, so they planned quickly for the war, and it started less than a month after September 11th. But one of the dilemmas was when they looked at the landscape, they realized, of course, that Pakistan was the Taliban's main supporter, and the Taliban had provided the sanctuary that al-Qaeda had used to carry out the attacks. So we kind of famously went to the Pakistanis, who had been our partners but were now kind of on the other side of the conflict, and we said, you're either with us or against us. Are we going to attack you, or are you going to help us against al-Qaeda and the Taliban? And the Pakistanis said, okay, we'll cooperate with you. And they did, but gradually, after the Taliban government fell and we became entangled in Iraq, the Pakistanis thought essentially they should go back to managing their own interests in the region, that we were gone, and that the Taliban were a necessary ally of theirs to gain influence in Afghanistan. And so they tolerated and then gradually facilitated the Taliban's comeback. And then when we came back to the war and escalated our combat and troop presence there after 2007, we found that we were now on the other side of the war from the Pakistanis, even though we were giving them hundreds of millions of dollars in aid. So it was quite an entanglement, and it's a puzzle that I think to this day we haven't really solved.
And Pakistan has been regarded as a U.S. ally, a country with nuclear capability. But also the country that it's almost certainly was involved in the harboring of Osama bin Laden. What's the relationship now with the American government and Pakistan?
Well, it's really shattered. There's lots of mistrust and bitterness on both sides. The Pakistanis have essentially reduced their relationship with the U.S., and now the Trump administration has suspended aid to Pakistan, basically calling out the Pakistan army for its support for the Taliban and saying, we're not going to give you money while you're supporting a group that is shooting at our troops in Afghanistan. So there is estrangement. The Pakistani strategy is basically to harbor inside its alliance with China, which has always been its most important alliance. And China has been, you know, given Pakistan a lot of cover over the decades for its nuclear program and for its alignment with violent radical Islamist groups.
Well, how stable is the government in Pakistan right now?
More stable than it was, you know, 6-8 years ago. Part of the problem during the late Bush administration and the Obama administration, as we surged our troops into Afghanistan and fought this counterinsurgency war against the Taliban, was that, you know, when we thought about putting pressure on Pakistan, suspending aid or listing it as a state sponsor of terrorism, the problem was that Pakistan was so unstable at that time. I mean, it was enduring the worst terrorism that Pakistan has ever known. Tens of thousands of Pakistanis lost their lives, and the Pakistani Taliban basically went to war against the Pakistan army and even the intelligence service that had succored it. They bombed barracks, they killed generals, they blew up ISI's own buildings. And with the country falling into such turmoil and possessing nuclear weapons and being the site of dozens of radical Islamist groups, the understandable feeling in Washington was, well, you know, if we put too much more pressure on this sandcastle, it's just going to melt and we're going to have loose nukes to worry about. So we were constrained. And now what Pakistan has done since then is they've concentrated, as any government would, on getting their own house in order. The security services have reduced the internal threat, and they've partly done that by pushing the radicals out of Pakistan back into Afghanistan, where they've made the war there worse. But as of the last couple of years, just the last couple of years, Pakistan has restored a significant measure of domestic security. It's still not paradise. I think 500 civilians died in terrorist attacks there last year, but that's much reduced from what it was before. And I think that may have entered into the Trump administration's calculus, where they thought, well, we can afford to put some pressure on this country now because they've kind of gotten back on their feet. They're not in danger of imminent collapse.
Based on what we know about the nuclear capability of Pakistan, is it a greater threat potentially than North Korea?
Well, North Korea has missiles that can reach the United States and apparently the capacity to put nuclear weapons on them. Pakistan does not. So in that sense, it doesn't pose a direct threat. Pakistan has made no hostile noises about the United States. It acquired its nuclear weapons to deter India from conducting a land invasion of the country. And now it's caught up in the, you know, sort of the complexity of China and its rivalry with India and India's rivalry with Pakistan. But the threat that Pakistan's nuclear program poses to the United States is really a classical one of the Hollywood thriller type, which is they have a lot of bombs, more than 100. They're building smaller bombs for reasons of their kind of deterrent theory. And they have a lot of terrorist groups. The book recounts a really frightening attack on a Pakistani ship in 2014 by naval officers who'd been radicalized and wanted to take over the ship and go off in the sea and fire missiles at American Navy. They were defeated, although it was quite an elaborate plan they had, very Hollywood-like. And later, India's intelligence service reported that there had been nuclear weapons on that ship. Maybe the attackers didn't know about it, but if they'd succeeded, they might have found themselves in possession of low-yield nuclear weapon or two.
With this region as complicated as it is, and the geographic density given the Pakistani and Afghan border, how can any sovereign nation really control the area?
Well, that's a question that the Pakistanis have been asking themselves for a lot of years, especially over the last 15 years when they've suffered from this internal rebellion coming out of those regions. And I think the army has been surprised in Pakistan that they've been able to move up to that border region and establish a military presence and not get thrown out. Now, there's a little bit of unrest from the people in that region underway right now, this week. But overall, they have succeeded in establishing more control along the Afghan border than they expected. And they've announced that their next plan is to build a fence It sounds familiar. And it's a very long border. It would be a very difficult fence to build. But, you know, at least the intention of that plan suggests their outlook, which is they want this border to mean something, and it has never meant anything to the people who live along it. They don't even recognize its legitimacy, and they travel back and forth and are linked by, you know, family and tribe and social networks. And so the effort by Pakistan to establish sovereignty over that border is one of their big national projects, and they're probably closer to it now than they've been ever since the country was founded in the aftermath of the Second World War.
What roles can China or Russia or India, maybe even Iran, what roles can they play in the events in Afghanistan?
They have a constructive role to play if we can figure out how to draw them into it, because one truth about the Afghan war in its 17th year and all the suffering that Afghans have endured, continue to endure from mass casualty attacks in the capital of Kabul and the grinding casualties of the war with the Taliban is that all of their neighbors, they share an interest in preventing Afghanistan from falling back into another catastrophic civil war that becomes an incubator for cross-border terrorism. China is threatened by the restive Western region in its country that can be influenced by terrorism coming out of Afghanistan. Pakistan has had a nightmarish decade of dealing with spillover violence. Iran is worried about the war destabilizing its country, and so on. And so it ought to be possible to muster the collective influence of those governments to try to shore up the Afghan war and to try to reduce the violence and instability that it's creating. But we have been fighting this on our own, by and large, and we say that we recognize there isn't a purely military solution in the war, but then we only prioritize military action and haven't come up with a way to negotiate or to find some more creative strategy for reducing the war's violence. It may not be possible to get a beautiful settlement of a pure peace in the war, but that kind of diplomacy can reduce the violence and reduce the instability that arises from a civil war of this type.
Are you optimistic?
No, I'm not. I mean, I feel as if the history across three administrations now, where there's been more continuity than change in the war, to be honest, despite maybe rhetorical differences, the policies have been pretty continuous since the second Bush term. We keep doing the same thing and expecting different results.
Well, congratulations on your important work. Director at S from Pulitzer Prize winner Steve Call. Steve, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
This is Jim Engster, and thank you for joining us for our final segment with C. Denise Marcel, State Representative, Democrat, Baton Rouge. She's been spending some quality time at the session. The special session, as we know, collapsed without success, and now a regular session is beginning Monday. And Denise Marcel, where do we stand right now?
Hopefully, we can get something done after the regular session. We've taken a stand as the Black Caucus, and not just the Black Caucus, some other members have decided that we shouldn't be just kicking this can down the road. And certainly I took a stand along with three other members of the Black Caucus to stand up against them balancing the budget on the backs of the poor and middle class. I didn't think it was necessary, and that's why I voted against the bill with the amendments on it. I supported the bill. I didn't support the amendments that were attached to it that were not even germane to the bill.
Well, as we look ahead to the regular session, the governor is saying we may have to abbreviate it to go into special session so that this fiscal cliff does not happen as right now it is planned for July 1st. So what are the options available at this point?
Pretty much the same. Some of the things that the Republicans did not want to consider were brackets, the excess itemized taxes that Representative Leger was proposing. And, of course, we were going to entertain 0.25 on the tax, the most regressive tax that anyone could have on the middle-class people. We were entertaining that as a compromise. Many of us have said all along that we promised the people that the tax would be temporary and it would be a bridge. However, we do not agree that it should be a bridge to nowhere. So we were going to compromise. We're still willing to compromise in order to get there. Because we've got to remember that we've got to fully fund the elderly and disabled, and we've got to talk about the Medicaid expansion and the waivers. We have people that are on the list, waiting list for waivers. We've got to figure out how to get there. We certainly support TOPS, but there are many, many issues. And I think all of us, what we need to realize is we're all on the cliff.
Representative Marcel, there are those who blame the governor, there are those who blame the speaker, there are those who blame factions of the House. Who was at fault as far as the special session collapsing?
The Republicans have control of the House. They have the majority of the members of the House. We have a speaker who goes out and makes statements concerning the four of us that stood together. That was myself, Representative Carter, Glover, and Harris, who stood and voted against House Bill 8 because it had the amendments. Now, he accused us of stopping that bill from going forward, but as I told him from the House floor, you know, you're the leader of this House, so you could lead by starting to vote for it yourself. If he would have voted for it, maybe he could have convinced me to vote for it, but I doubt it. He should have been able to get the other Republicans, someone to come along with him, to pass anything that he wanted to pass. They have the majority of the House. You're not going to force Democrats or the other side to bend to pass taxes while you have a group of no on your side saying we're not going to pass any taxes, but you want us to pass them. So, I mean, it's a game. I don't want to point one particular finger. I just don't like it when we have a speaker that does those types of things and calls people out for voting the way they vote. And I vote and stand up for my people all the time, continuously. I will not apologize for doing that. I think that I did the right thing. I will entertain some percentage of that tax, but it is the most regressive tax on the middle class and the underserved, while corporations and out-of-state interests, they go free. And it's not fair to the citizens of the state of Louisiana. And this mess was made and created by our former governor, Jindal. The governor has done a great job in turning some of that stuff around. For starters, we accepted the Medicaid expansion, and that has had a significant impact on the budget, but nobody says anything about it.
How poisonous is the atmosphere right now?
I think when we left, it was pretty poisonous, but I think at some point we get back together. If we have some genuine leadership in the House that's willing to work with the Senate, I think we can no longer say we're going to, you know, hold our noses and vote for things that we don't want, and we're going to send it over to the Senate side for them to fix it. We got to develop bipartisan solutions, come across the aisle. We got to talk about seriously about how do we fund health care? How do we fully fund our education? What are we going to do to promote all the great people of our state, not a select few, and certainly not the riches of the rich, while we leave the middle class holding the bag?
Now, U.S. Senator John Kennedy, Representative Marcel, is accusing the governor of, quote, trying to tax the state into prosperity. Kennedy says that Louisiana voters do not believe the state has a financial crisis. What do you make of Senator Kennedy's remarks?
Apparently, Senator Kennedy has not looked at our budget, and certainly he needs to tell that to the citizens who are looking for TOPS. He needs to tell that to people who need health care, and he also needs to tell that to people in higher ed, because that's who's going to take the brunt of these cuts. We didn't dream this up. We didn't dream up that we came into the governor inherited a $1 billion deficit, a $2 billion deficit, I'm sorry, when he got here. This hole was dug for us. And to say that he's sitting up there saying that perhaps he want to come here and see if he can do a better job, I'm so tired of hearing people saying we have a spending problem. No, we had a spending problem. When we were privatizing all of our hospitals, we were privatizing all of our jails, and now it's costing the state more money to operate the same services that we controlled as a state. That was done under Jindal's administration. So I say to him, I would love to see him come here and talk to the parents who are on waiting lists for waivers for services. The GO grants are underfunded. Even though we fund a TOPS at $300 million, we don't get 25% of that for the GO grants. So there are a lot of people who are suffering, who want to be educated. And by the way, the senator needs to know that we've been ranked last. And that was by no fault of this governor or this leadership in the House or Senate, but this was previous years. We didn't get here today or yesterday. We've been here for a while.
Are there those who would like to see this governor fail?
I do believe so. And, you know, Representative Barry Ivey said it really frankly. I commend him. He's a Republican. He lives in Baton Rouge. I went over to him, and I told him I was proud that he was able to have the courage to go to the floor and tell the truth about the what the Republicans have told him, that they want this governor to fail. They do not want him to come out with a win, and it's really, really sad. We've got to look at who we're sending to these seats. The people of Louisiana need to take a close look, not at Republican versus Democrat, but who's voting in their interest and who is standing in the way of their interest in the state. So, yes, I do believe there is a plan that is devised to make sure that this governor fails. He will be running next year, and they want to take this seat away. I don't know why. They didn't do a good job with it under Jindal's administration. In fact, they dug us into this hole. But, yes, to answer your question, yes, I do believe it's an attack on the governor.
The president of LSU, King Alexander, will be with us on Monday. And Denise Marcel, colleges and universities have been hit hard by budget cuts for a decade now. And LSU has been hit with a sledgehammer. But what about Southern University? What about the other schools in the state?
All of the schools need the funding that we are currently giving them. In fact, they need more funding than we're currently funding them at. The problem with it is people need to look at it overall holistically and say, that's why we don't have a spending problem. There is a need. So King Alexander can come to the radio show and to the forefront, and also the chancellor at Southern University, they can come forward and say, this is not a myth. We need these funds. We have the less educated people in the world. And why do you think? The less trained people in the world, the more crime, the crime rates are crazy. And we're incarcerating people at a rate that's higher than anywhere else in the world. So something that we're doing here just isn't right. So I say to them that they're absolutely correct. We are fighting every day so that those universities, not just Southern University and LSU, but the BRCCs, which is a great institution that's in my district, so that these schools will be fully funded. And so we have people that sit on the other side of the aisles from us that say that we have a spending problem. But what is it in the budget that you want to take out? Besides the fact that you want to put Medicaid requirements on a fiscal bill, that's absolutely insane. The idea that looking to find any problems or any fraud in Medicaid is going to help us is ludicrous. It's going to cost us $80 million to put that in place. We don't have to recreate the wheel. We can go and look at the wheel over in Kentucky. That's what it's costing them. And so we don't have any money, yet we're willing to spend $80 million. We've got to get 13 analysts and 2 supervisors to even implement the program. But that's the same Republicans that say we have a spending problem. So I'd like to know what Senator thinks about that.
Representative Marcel, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Good luck Monday and the rest of the session, and we'll be calling again soon.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.